Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Hey, this is Sam Cedar. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. On today's show, the International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson, will join us to discuss why her union was so instrumental in the government shutdown. We'll talk of some of the big battles she's fighting right now that affect us all when we fly. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project will be here to discuss how the Democrats are doing since taking over the House. And where has all the Democratic mobilization gone? Voting rights expert Ari Berman on two big cases regarding gerrymandering heading to the U.S. Supreme Court. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to discuss the biggest news stories from the week. And The Atlantic's Yasmin Saran will attempt to explain Brexit to us. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. And if you like the show, support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up now. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, of course, the big news, which actually happened really over last weekend, and we had really no sense of any of it as of last Friday, when I think at about 6 p.m. or so, Robert Mueller wrapped up his investigation, delivered the Mueller report to the Attorney General. And basically, all we know from the report at this point is about two sentences, or really, I guess more technically speaking, two sentence fragments. The most important thing that we know, or the most definitive thing we know at this point, is that Robert Mueller will not be bringing any more indictments. There are no more indictments. There are no more arrests associated with the specific investigation of anyone from the Trump campaign working with anyone from the Russian government on the, the endeavor of influencing the election. We know from the letter that Attorney General Barr put out, to the extent that, you know, we can know anything from that letter, but to the extent that if we take that letter at face value, we know that Robert Mueller found that there was interference in the U.S. election by the Russians. Frankly, we sort of knew that, and I don't think it's terribly surprising that they would do this. We don't know how much it influenced the election, but we know that they engaged in influencing the election. And according to what we know from the letter issued by the Attorney General, there will be no more criminal indictments associated with that. That doesn't mean there's no evidence. It's just that to the extent that there was evidence, maybe there was no evidence. We have no idea. But to the extent that there was evidence, it did not meet a threshold. Generally, most prosecutors will say they need 85% and I don't know how they measure that, 85% assuredness that they can prove that a crime was committed. I would imagine that threshold's much higher when you're talking about the president. And We also know that Robert Mueller was under, basically, at the instruction of the Department of Justice, that a president can't be indicted. So it would have had to have been other players, and you would have probably need a very high threshold for that as well. So that's where we are, and we're waiting to see if we're going to see the report in any, you know, reasonable facsimile as to what the report said.
Well, that's absolutely right, and that's one of the big questions I still have here is, you know, it's not even a question, really. I know the answer to it, so I'm not questioning it. Barr did not have to issue that letter the way that he did, right? I mean, they got the report last Friday, and they decided that they had to issue some kind of principal conclusions instantly. And so they took 48 hours, they put together that letter, which was a very terse and short letter, just saying what they had decided were the principal conclusions. I think it's clear that we don't know what Robert Mueller's principal conclusions about any of this were. This is what Barr decided, apparently with the help of Rod Rosenstein, the assistant attorney general. What strikes me about that is that the only way that that letter can be seen as anything but a political document, looking at what is in it and the fact that, as you point out, they only quoted Mueller himself very sparsely and in a way that raises more questions than it answers, because, you know, they didn't quote whole sentences. He just, you know, plucked out little pieces of certain sentences to sort of back up what he was saying. And so all it does is make you wonder what else, you know, what was he saying before it got to that in the sentence, right? I mean, this just it just begs for more information.
Right.
And, you know, obviously he did this to try and set the narrative coming out of this that the president had been exonerated on the collusion and that Barr himself had determined that he had been exonerated on the obstruction of justice. Well, there was no reason that they had to do it that way. It's a political document, and it should have been seen that way by everyone. Barr was perfectly within his rights to say, hey, look, I need to take a week here. This is a big thing. I got to digest it. And he could have pulled out big chunks and sections of the report, even if they were redacted or whatever, to back up, you know, with evidence what this was saying. He could have, you know, said, hey, look, I'm not going to give anything. I got to look at this thing. I'm not going to tell you what's in it until I know for sure. All of that would have lent the whole exercise credibility, because it would have said, you know, look, we're going to be very careful here. Instead, he just vomits out this four-page political, you know, PR document, which I think has left, you know, most people who were thinking about this unsatisfied. And it gave, of course, it set a narrative for Trump and his enablers. And unfortunately, the media has gone for it hook, line, and sinker, and has decided to sort of run with that. I can't tell you how many times people are saying, well, the Mueller report said this and the Mueller report said that, and, you know, actually conflating that with Barr's letter, which is, of course, what the whole point was. They wanted to be able to say, look, this whole thing's over. He was cleared, and all of you who are still asking questions are just a bunch of nitpickers, and you're all just, you know, sitting there, you refuse, you won't let it go. I mean, you know, and, you know, of course, you know, we're all going to have to sit there and listen to that. It's not true. We don't know what the report says, and we may not, you know, for a long time. And what we finally get from Mueller or from Barr, you know, the longer what they're calling a summary, the longer summary may be unsatisfying. But at the very least, I would have hoped that the media would, you know, present this letter as for what it is, which was definitely a political document. It is not anything on any legal that you can accept on a legal basis or on a political basis for anyone but the true believers. And yet, you know, we're sort of stuck here in this holding pattern for the moment. So, you know, aside from the substance, I just wanted to say that, you know, I really think it's important that we keep the Barr letter in perspective for what it really is, what it was clearly designed to do, and, you know, hold our fire until we hear more.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I think the failure, it seems to me, the media, and there's certainly, I think, without a doubt, some elements of the media that got out in front of this story more so than perhaps it warranted. Of course, the allure of ratings, I think, drove some of this. But, you know, people have to remember, this investigation started way before Donald Trump was president of the United States. It started in the context of a national security investigation. It was not criminal until, I think, months after after it began, and I think after even the president became president. And it, I'm not quite sure what the option was. Now, there were a lot of people, to be, you know, to be frank, who went on, made careers for themselves in some respects out of, you know, pontificating about something that they didn't necessarily know about. But the investigation has gone on. The irony is, of course, people continue to do that now, and we still don't know what's in that report. Like, we have, you know, some, maybe an inkling of a shadow of it. But throughout this process, it's been a political process because, according to the Department of Justice, a sitting president cannot be indicted. All right, well, right. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this a little bit more. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio, talking to the great Digby. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
Sam Cedar here. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we're talking about the Mueller report, but there is no Mueller report. We're talking about the sort of the shadow of the Mueller report, and we don't even know if it's an accurate shadow. It is a summation of, and do we know the size of it, of the report?
No. Nope.
How big it
nope.
is? It could be a 5-page document. It could be a 500-page document. All we know is a 4-page letter that has a couple of phrases from the report commingled with an interpretation of that report by an attorney general who was known as the fixer for the Iran-Contra affair. Under George Herbert Walker Bush, by an attorney general who, and we'll talk about this perhaps in the next hour, who, according to reports, was simply overruled by the White House as to the Justice Department's stance on yep. the Affordable Care Act in the Fifth Circuit. Now, so the relationship between the president and this attorney general is an interesting one, to say the least. But all right, so your thoughts here. So we know from the letter, at least, that Attorney General Barr, that there is no indictments that we can expect from this question of whether Trump campaign people actively engaged with Russian government people to influence the election. We know that the Russian government did influence the election, according to the report. And we know that on some level, Mueller did not make a call on obstruction. And Barr, at the least, decided that there was none based upon presumably what he read in the report. But of course, we know that he believed there was no obstruction even before he had the job. In fact, that was his job resume. An argument that there was no obstruction before he knew what was in the case. So where does that leave us? I mean, what give me just your sense of how all this went down, and you know, whether you think there is some culpability within the media for hyping something that turns out to not have been as nefarious as advertised.
Well, taking the first part, I think that the way it went down, I think it's pretty, you know, pretty clear. I mean, I think that Barr was hired on the basis of that memo that he sent to the White House unsolicited, a 16-page memo, you know, four times as long as this letter that he sent out last weekend, saying that he felt that he believed that Mueller's theory of obstruction was fatally misconceived, were the words that he used. And, you know, Trump didn't know him, but I think that was among Trump's lawyers. They were saying, hey, man, you know, this is your guy. You know, he's the one to replace Sessions. And they knew that Sessions was going to be replaced at some point, right? I mean, they waited till after the election, but the midterms. And this was the guy they had. And they knew that he would be able to pass muster for the Senate and that he would be able to get in there. And this was apparently, according to everything that we've read, that what Trump's lawyers were truly concerned about was the fact that Trump had blatantly obstructed justice. And we've seen it. I mean, this is not hidden. We know he obstructed justice on his Twitter feed, right? He's dangling pardons. He's calling people rats. He's demeaning the attorney general and saying that he shouldn't have recused. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And then there's stuff, even according to Barr, that we don't know about Trump's obstruction. So this was clearly his biggest danger as far as the lawyers were concerned, because it was, I think it was likely that there's way more evidence than not that that's what he did. Now, it's a hard thing to prove because of intent. You have to be able to do that, and I think that Mueller, for some reason, which will need to be explained, felt that he couldn't personally interview the president, which, who knows? I mean, Trump would have lied, of course, and his lawyers knew that, and that's probably why they wouldn't let him be interviewed. But what that would have proven, I don't know. Nonetheless, you know, that was obviously a big part of this, and I think that Mueller, nobody knows why Mueller, you know, punted to the Justice Department on making the decision. But the most logical thing to me, most people who know him and they've been talking on TV say, you know, it's really not like him. He's not afraid to make the hard decisions. It's just not, you know, and that's what a special counsel is supposed to do. The precedent in these situations, though, suggests that the reason that he did it, as Leon Jaworski did and as Ken Starr did, under different rules. Jaworski was under a special counsel rule, and Ken Starr was under the independent counsel rule laws statute. But both of them declined to make that obstruction charge, and instead they felt that it was a political decision, and they left it up to the political players, i.e., the Congress. Or perhaps in Mueller's case, he thought that Barr was a political player. But in any case, he felt that it was beyond his scope. And that's, I think, the best guess right on what he was doing there. Especially considering you can't indict a president, right? I mean, it's like,
right.
You know, so what's the point? Why am I doing this? what was the reason that I did this if the president can't be indicted and I found evidence of his behavior? So I think, you know, my suspicion is that's why that happened. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, you know, Barr, I think, has now shown that he is a political player in this, and it's unlikely to me that this is going to go down without a fight, that there's going to be, you know, what's going to happen on the obstruction charges. The White House is going to claim executive privilege. It will have to be litigated between the Congress. They'll go to court, and, you know, there'll be a lot of back and forth, as Nixon did with the tapes, right? It's exactly the same situation.
Right. Well,
so, you know, we'll have to see how that goes.
All right. Well, we've got to take a break. We can touch on this again in the next hour, because this question of obstruction is a fascinating one. And of course, we're a little bit stumbling around in the dark. But that is all we have been given by the U.S. Justice Department for the time being. But we got to take a break. We'll be back with more Ring of Fire. Digby will join me in the next hour. I'm Sam Cedar. Right back after this. Just ahead, we'll discuss the importance of labor during the government shutdown with the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Here's a timely reminder, since you're currently listening to Ring of Fire Live. You know that you can access Ring of Fire on demand on your desktop, on your laptop, on your tablet, your smartphone. That's right. Ring of Fire is available on demand, so you can listen commercial free at your convenience. To subscribe to the podcast and gain access to the news the mainstream media misses, and all the interviews with lawmakers, lawbreakers, and newsmakers. Never miss a minute and support our effort at the same time. It's a sweet deal. Check it out, the Ring of Fire commercial-free podcast on demand whenever and wherever you want to listen. Just $7.95 a month, or for real savings, $59.40 a year. Help us continue to bring you quality investigative reporting, whistleblowing, and our patented, insightful, fearless commentary. Just head to ringoffireradio.com and click on podcast and sponsor at the top of the page. Hello, you. You who listens to the Ring of Fire podcast. Whether you listen to our one-hour podcast weekly, or you're a supporting member of Ring of Fire Radio who listens to our bonus content and our three-hour weekly commercial-free show. Speaking for Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio, we can't tell you how much we appreciate your listening. And now you have an opportunity to introduce others to the progressive ideas, issues, and voices you hear each week on Ring of Fire Radio. Help us win an award at podcastawards.com. Head over to podcastawards.com and nominate us for Best News in Politics Award. You can send a message as we compete against the right-wing and corporate news shows that there is a hunger in this country for truth-telling and progressive ideals. Go to podcastawards.com and nominate Ring of Fire Radio for Best in News in Politics right now. Hey, thanks for your help. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Cedar. We'll be back with a new show next week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest was recently profiled in the New York Times for her work as the president of the Association of the Flight Attendants. Here to discuss her role and why it's been such an important one lately, Sarah Nelson. So, Sarah, very happy to have you on the program. Wanted to talk to you really since the resolution of the government shutdown. I happen to believe that the biggest untold story of the government shutdown is the role of labor in ending that shutdown, and specifically your union in that context. But before we get into that story, the TikTok of that, and then I also want to talk to you about the latest action you folks are taking in regards to Frontier and more broadly the union movement in this country. Just tell us, give us some of the basic facts of the flight attendant union in this country.
Sure. The Association of Flight Attendants represents 50,000 flight attendants across 20 different airlines. We were founded in 1945, had the first contract in 1946 at United Airlines, and we have worked over the years to beat back all the discriminatory practices that tried to keep this as a job, had young women have to leave the profession if they turned age 30, if they got married, if they got pregnant. We had to step on a weight scale until 1993, and of course, originally it was only a job for women, so we also had to fight for the rights of men to have the same rights as women on the job. And that is our history. Today, what we're doing is representing people from all genders, races, cultures, and creeds who make up the flight attendant profession. Anyone with the heart of a flight attendant can have this as their chosen career. And we fight for economic justice on the job, and we fight for safety for our members and for the traveling public.
And I imagine I can only imagine having just had experience, obviously, flying and seeing my fellow passengers that it's a trying position at times. I imagine that requires some support in the context of dealing with management.
Well, look, we wouldn't have this career if it wasn't for our union. We wouldn't have many of the safety regulations if it wasn't for our union. We fought for clean water on the planes. We fought for the FDA inspection of our food on the planes. We fought for clean air. We got rid of smoking on the planes. These were all the actions of our flight attendant union. None of this was initiated by management. In some case, we brought them to our way of thinking. But none of this would have happened if it wasn't for our flight attendant union.
All right. So let's talk about your union in the context of the government shutdown. I think there was a lot of folks who were saying over the course of the shutdown that we weren't really going to see any type of movement, frankly, until we started to see problems in air travel. Before you get into the role that labor played, why do you think it is that air travel in particular has the ability to make people more conscious of what the government does?
Well, look, everybody is connected to air travel. And you can just think about this. If you were alive on 9/11 and the days immediately following that, everyone would say that they could remember the quietness of the skies and how strange that was. That we're all used to looking up at different places all over the country and seeing planes in the skies. And our air transportation system is really what connects our entire country. It's how we move the vast majority of our mail and services and goods. And it is what people think of as their connection to their loved ones or to getting to the important business meeting or to celebrating a marriage or to remember those that we love when they've passed. And so this is really what connects all of us. And it is a common denominator across genders, races, cultures, and creeds. It is a microcosm of America on every single one of those metal tubes that goes up in the air every day.
So, all right. So walk us through this, because there was a lot of people who felt that what we were going to see is that we're looking to our specifically to the air traffic controllers, specifically as the sort of the pivot point of the stability of air travel. And in some ways, it ended up being the air traffic air controllers, but it ended up being the TSA folks and you folks who sort of, I guess, ratcheted up. Tell me about the dynamic of how this, because I remember that morning, it was a Friday morning where there was reports that LaGuardia had been shut down for an hour, that I think it was in Philadelphia, in Miami. And I mean, at that moment, it was clear that it was just a matter of time, and it ended up being literally just a matter of hours. But give me the sense of the dynamic, the interplay between those different constituencies who were able to put pressure on airline travel.
Sure. Well, first of all, airline travel doesn't happen without an incredible public and private partnership. The federal government is so completely intertwined with the private business of the airlines that one cannot function without the other. And so anytime there's a government shutdown, we have opposed that. We have expressed concern. It has an impact on safety and security. If you start having people come to work and telling them that they're not going to get paid, that has an impact and a distraction on safety. I learn in my flight attendant training every year, the very first thing we learn is that when you're doing safety sensitive work, you remove all distractions. Any distraction can cause a disruption to safety. So not paying people is a very, very acute distraction, and it really created an unsafe space. The other thing that it did was it stopped all of the infrastructure planning and the programs that help support safety and security. So anything that was in process to improve the safety and security or to upgrade it or to update it or to fill in staffing behind of people who are leaving in the normal course of the operation, retirements or medical leaves or what have you. None of that was happening. And so every single day that the shutdown went on, those safety nets that we have, the layers of safety and security that are there that keep us safe, were getting stretched further and further. And it was creating holes. And it was creating the possibility of a catastrophic incident. And so every single day that that happened, we became more and more concerned as flight attendants. And as federal workers, they not only do not have the right to strike, but as we learned from PATCO in 1981, those strikers can actually be federally prosecuted. They can even lose their freedom, not to mention losing the right to have their job or to return to work in any government position. So those labor laws are really abysmal. And if you think about it, in private business, No one would go to work without getting paid or being told that they're not going to get paid. That would end on day one. For the 2 million people who either went without work or without pay, they would have been given a WARN notice of at least 60 days and been able to plan for that. None of that happened. But under federal labor law, these workers didn't have the right to strike. And so it really required defining for the public what was at stake. And when you say there wasn't really any action, or a lot of people said there wasn't going to be action until this was affecting air travel, what that really means is that air travel is something that can affect every single person's self-interest, and they can relate to that, and they can be concerned about stopping air travel. And so that is where our politics converge. That is where our interests converge. And what we did, spent a lot of time with the air traffic controllers and with the transportation security officers and with the pilots doing in a partnership between public and private unions, is we defined for the public what was at stake here. And the air traffic controllers could only do this job for so long without having those distractions be such a stressor on them that they medically could not do that work. And what we told the public was, in any other job, if you do your job at 99.5% rate of efficiency, you are stellar. You are going to get awards. And if the air traffic controllers come to work and they have a 99.5% effective day, that means 50 airplanes go down that day. Right. So this, there was a lot at stake here, and we had to define that. And so a week before the flight started to stop at LaGuardia, our union also started to stand up and say, look, we have got to understand really what's at stake here, and we need to talk about a general strike. Because if Washington isn't going to do their job, these people are going to continue to follow through on the oath that they've given to this country and go to work and perform these safety and security functions. But the same people that they report to are not going to do their job to make sure that they have the pay and the support and the systems up and running to support the work that they're doing. Then we've got to step up and stop everything and make Washington do its job. So we had been calling for a general strike. Our union had been preparing to withhold our service because we were getting to a place where this was just simply unsafe to be on planes. And we were very loud about that. And the air traffic controllers were really only doing what was within their rights after right. defining it so clearly for the American public. And we got the attention because we were able to, as a private union, talk about the fact that we were not going to continue to go to work under those conditions.
All right. Well, Sarah Nelson, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the union movement more broadly. And if we are seeing in this country a renewed sense that workers have more power than they have contemplated in the past, and withholding their labor can promote benefits for the entire society. Also want to talk about what's happening with Frontier Air. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hi, I'm Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire. In order to continue to bringing you the news and opinions that matter to progressives, we encourage you to help support our efforts. You can do that by shopping on Amazon.com using the link on our website at ringoffireradio.com. Ring of Fire will receive a portion of all sales that originate through our site, so you can shop as usual and help support progressive media. Just bookmark the Amazon link at ringoffireradio.com and help support progressive media.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. So, Sarah, in the last segment, you basically walked us through the more or less the TikTok that I believe was, and there was a lot of credit for, you know, the Democratic politicians holding the caucus together, not caving on the government shutdown. But when you issued a press release basically saying on that Friday, as the head of the flight attendants union, Mitch McConnell, I hope you can hear us now. Something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing.
Do we have your attention now?
Do we have your attention now? And you did. And quickly, things turned around. The government reopened. And when I think there were threats coming from Donald Trump and the Republican Party to shut it down again, you folks were out there again saying we are prepared not to waste any time this time around. So let me ask you this in that context. Do you sense, I mean, you know, this, your union's action comes in the wake of a lot of strikes that have been happening in the education sector. We have seen teachers' unions and teachers' associations flex the muscle of labor in this country in a way we haven't seen, I think, it really, I mean, in such a broad way in decades. I've had the opportunity to talk to teachers, union heads, who all told me to a person, we're going to use this power more. We didn't realize really in many respects that we had it, and we left this power too dormant. Do you have a sense that there's something changing in the way that labor perceives itself in this country?
Well, I think whether labor gets it or not, the average American has had enough. The rubber band is breaking all over the country. And you take those teacher strikes, for example, you know, the teachers have the support of their entire communities. That's because everything centers around education. If there's not good education in your school district, the businesses that we're trying to attract to that area are not going to want to come, because they are going to do an assessment of whether or not the employees that they have can put their kids into good schools. Everything is connected. And what we're starting to see is that there is a commonality in the experience of the American worker, whether it is a public or private job. Pensions have been gutted, and there is a continued attack on the remaining pensions. There has been more and more move to Wall Street instead of reinvesting in companies and working for the good of those companies to succeed and sharing in the success with the employees. More and more is given in stock buybacks to Wall Street and in executive bonuses. And this is the same narrative happening across the country. You see that right now there's an attack on healthcare and an inability to have even a conversation about climate change and how that's affecting all of us. And people are sick and tired of Washington not working, of Wall Street trying to take all of the profits and productivity that this American, the American workers are turning out. And people are seeing a commonality here. And the old tactics of dividing people through racism and sexism, people are starting to wise up and see that those really were bosses' tactics. And we have to come together as workers and stand up and use our power, because we do have power. You know, when I first started talking about our union withholding our service, the first question I got was, well, what are the pilots going to do? Well, that was maybe a sexist question. It was maybe an idea that only some workers have power, or some workers have more power than others. And in a very short time, that question went away. And, you know, mad respect for my friends in the flight deck, and we coordinated a lot of work on this. But the reality is that flight attendants had enough power to shut the system down, and people started to realize that. And so workers have incredible power when they come together and exercise that power together. And in a time when that can also be recognized by the public as part of something for the public good, we're in a good position to exercise that power as workers and fight for our country, fight for our democracy, fight for good health care, fight for good green jobs with good labor protections and good jobs for people, not just green. We can really make some strides here, and workers can flex their muscle to really fix what's wrong with this country.
You know, I think just the biggest change I think that I think we're seeing in the union movement is that union leaders like yourself are talking about issues that are not specific to your union members, that ones that are shared across the community. But with that said, we got 2 minutes left, so I want to hear also about what's happening in terms of Frontier. This is an airline which seems to have consistently underpaid its flight staff. What's happening with just about a minute and a half left here? What's happening on that front?
Yeah, so Frontier, we were successful in getting a contract, and we were successful because Frontier flight attendants turned out a 99% strike vote, and they were out there picketing and making it very clear that they were willing to make good on that strike vote. And we were able to negotiate a contract, the terms of which are not going to be released until later this week, but that will be life-changing and dramatically improve the pay, the working conditions, and the benefits for Frontier flight attendants. And this is going to finally make Frontier pay when they have pocketed massive profits off the flight attendants' backs for years based on a bankruptcy and an inability to or a refusal to get to the table and negotiate terms that were competitive with the rest of the industry. So we just made them pay by flight attendants standing up and saying that they were willing to use their power together to fight back.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but I'm curious, when you, as a union leader, when you have a successful a threat of a strike and it turns out this successful, what does it do for the rest of the union in terms of loading for bear for the next fight?
Well, look, sometimes you have to beat it out of them. Sometimes they have to just remember the beating they're going to take if they don't deal with you fairly. And what we find is that with power comes respect. So when we have been successful in our strike action, what we have seen is a respect that comes from management and an ability to work together better than ever before. And that's the result. When you stand together and you use your power, you're going to get results and you're going to have them remember what happens if they step out of line.
Sarah Nelson, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Nelson is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. AFL-CIO, United Airlines flight attendants since 1996. Today, the AFA-CWA represents nearly 50,000 flight attendants at 20 different airlines across the country. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.
Awake on my airplane, awake on my airplane. My skin is bare, my skin is theirs. Awake on my airplane, awake on my airplane. My skin is bare, my skin is theirs.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to justcoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. Justcoffee.coop.
Hey, this is Sam Cedar. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. We are back. This is the second hour of the show, and back to help me run down the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the first hour, we covered a lot of what we know, which is not that much, about the ending of the Mueller investigation. The most, I think, specific thing and concrete thing we know is that there will not be any more indictments from the Mueller investigation. People should remember that Mueller was very specifically dealing only with stuff that happened during the campaign. There were certain things that he that he basically handed over to the Southern District of New York. We don't know if he handed over anything else to other jurisdictions. These are ongoing investigations. Who knows where they're going to lead? But we do know there's not going to be indictments specifically addressing the prospect of members of the Trump campaign working directly with Russian members of the Russian government to interfere with the 2016 election. Now, there was Russian interference, but according to what we know from the Mueller report, which is really, again, only Attorney General Barr's summation of it, and this guy's a political player, but presumably this information is going to come out at one point, that there was not enough evidence to issue an indictment against other members of the Trump campaign. Now, here's my question to you. Before we go to just that one element of what I think people forget is that this did not start as a criminal investigation. But before we get there, do we have any sense if Mueller ever interviewed any of, and we know that the president only answered a couple of written questions, refused to sit down and actually be interviewed by Mueller. What about Ivanka Trump? What about Donald Trump Jr.? What about Jared Kushner? Do we know if these people were ever interviewed?
I think Kushner was, but the others weren't. And that's a question that we should, you know, have answered. These were people working in, obviously Trump Jr. was working as, you know, a member of the campaign when he took that meeting at Trump Tower. It is a very interesting and necessary question to be answered. In fact, there are a lot of them. You know, this is one of the things that I think is vitally important. And it, just to hit back on what we were talking about earlier, you know, the media did, you know, it's been hysterical, right, for 2 years, and we've all been that way. I write about it virtually every week. I mean, it's just, you know, it's an endless cycle. Let's not forget that Donald Trump himself has pumped this story by over and over and over again, going crazy in public on his Twitter feed. You know, he has not acted like a normal president does in these situations, you know, the way Clinton did or the way Reagan did or even the way Nixon did. You know, for the most part, they kept their, you know, they stayed quiet. Every once in a while, they'd make a public statement. They tried to give the impression that they were just carrying on the job of president. Trump has been, you know, he is as much at fault as the media for making this, you know, a gigantic story. And frankly, it is the most important scandal of our lifetimes, maybe ever, because the suspicion was that we have a president who may have been acting under the influence of or as an agent of a foreign power to win the election and then, you know, deliver for them afterwards, which brings up the other part of the Mueller investigation that we still know nothing about. Nothing. I mean, it wasn't even addressed in Barr's report, which is the fact that this was a counterintelligence investigation. And Andy McCabe, when he was doing his book tour, made it very clear that counterintelligence investigation, that was briefed to the Gang of Eight, right? I mean, they opened that up at the same time that they started looking at you know, Trump's, you know, potential collusion or conspiracy with the Russian government. That counterintelligence investigation was not addressed in the Barr letter, and for probably for good reason. It's classified. And what that means is we don't have any idea, none yet, whether or not Trump was under the influence of the Russian government, whether he and his team actively, or what do they say, tacitly or explicitly coordinated on the election interference activities, which are the exact words that were used in Barr's letter, whether or not they did that has nothing to do with whether or not Trump was under the influence of the Russian, you know, of the Russian government as a candidate or beyond. And basically, we know Trump was compromised. He was. And the reason for that is he lied about that Trump Tower Moscow meeting for years. He lied to the public. He lied to everybody. And that meant that just as Michael Flynn, you know, when Sally Yates ran up to the White House to claim that, you know, to warn them about Michael Flynn lying about his phone calls with Kislyak, because that meant that they had leverage over him. This means the fact that Trump lied about the Trump Tower Moscow project means that the Russians had leverage over him. Whether they exercised it, we don't know. I'm sure that's part of the counterintelligence investigation, right? I mean, they're trying to figure out whether or not Trump acted upon that, whether or not his behavior was related to that. But we can see a lot of that already. So, you know, this stuff doesn't go away. And, you know, however, whether or not he has criminal liability, I mean, I think some of this kind of reveals the fact that we don't have laws to preclude presidential candidates or even presidents from, you know, being under the influence of a foreign country because they have business deals there. I mean, that's just something that was completely unanticipated, I think.
Right.
You know, nobody thought anyone would ever do that. So we're kind of stuck in this weird position. We don't know what he did, and it may remain classified. I mean, hopefully, I think that the big thing that we have to wait for is to see whether or not Adam Schiff, who has announced that he's going to get a briefing from the FBI on all this stuff, a classified briefing, that whether or not out of that we will ever find out whether or not they looked further into all that stuff and whether or not that's still a salient thing. Because I just can't help thinking about Helsinki and wondering, you know, okay, maybe you didn't collude in the election, but boy, you know, there's something going on there. I think we all have a right to get some answers about that.
Right. And, I mean, without a doubt, there's he announced that he fired this FBI, the FBI chief, because of the investigation. I mean, that in and of itself is, I think, you know, sort of should set off some alarm bells. It's quite possible that Donald Trump is just that bat crap crazy, but okay. I mean, it's possible. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I want to take a break here, and we're going to go in the next segment. We're going to talk about, you know, for years we heard, you know, keep your eye on the ball. Donald Trump is a master at distraction. He is going to, you know, try and distract you by creating this story or that story. And this week he did it to himself. Because
yep.
The other big headline is that the Trump administration is going back and trying to basically repeal the Affordable Care Act again, this time through the courts, and that's stepping all over his victory lap. So I am certainly open to the suggestion that Donald Trump is just a little bit of a lunatic, and that's why he acted in this way. But if that's the case, then we should see the public report. We should see a report that basically lets the American public know, hey, now that you know there's not going to be any investigations, you were never in danger of having a, you know, double secret agent as president or whatnot. He's just a fool. And, you know, a dangerous fool, but that's not what the report would say. All right. Well, look, well, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about that. The decision that Donald Trump has made to step all over his ticker tape parade. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
Sam Cedar here. You're looking for the best of Ring of Fire Radio. We're
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, we've been talking about the non-Mueller report, or at least the deliverance of the Mueller report to William Barr, the Attorney General, and William Barr's assessment of the report, and his he is now deciding what part of the report will be allowed to see because it exonerates President Trump, but you wouldn't want to exonerate him too much. You wouldn't want to make it seem like he was bragging by releasing the full report and having us all see how exonerated he is. He's too modest to do that. So they're going to have to redact a bunch of things and allow the White House to review it before they put it out. But another interesting story involving William Barr this week was the decision of the White House to overrule the supposedly independent lawyer of the United States, his decision to not reverse the government's position on an Affordable Care Act case in the Fifth Circuit Court in Texas, where plaintiffs have been arguing that because Congress rolled back the mandate by saying that you're not going to get taxed if you don't buy health insurance, because Congress did that, they automatically rescinded the whole, meant to rescind the whole bill, because when the first Affordable Care Act was passed as law, Congress felt that it would include the mandate, and so the bill, the law is not severable, is what they say. Now, if this doesn't make sense to folks, what I'm saying, it's because it doesn't make sense, right? Like, Congress, you cannot argue that Congress did not contemplate this bill existing, this law existing without the mandate, when the reason why the law exists without the mandate is because Congress got rid of the mandate. So, but that's the argument. And now the U.S. government is officially arguing against itself, has taken the side of the plaintiffs, a bunch of states. And all the Republicans are pulling their hair out because they realize that they lost anywhere from, you know, a dozen to two dozen seats, basically because of their health care positions. And this has basically got the Democrats talking about something different. And it makes sense.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, it's just like, you know, Trump apparently, according to the reporting, he was listening to Mick Mulvaney, who's a Tea Partying, you know, extremist, basically. And Mick Mulvaney and his you know, henchman, who now is running he's an acting director of the OMB, who was Mulvaney's chief of staff or something when he was in the Congress. These guys are just, you know, they want, this is their holy grail, is repealing Obamacare. And they convinced him, against the advice of the Health and Human Services, Chief Azar, and Bill Barr, the Attorney General. He ordered them, apparently, to just do it. And apparently he ordered Barr to do it, and Barr said, well, you know, what can I do? Okay, boss, you know, and he did it, which is, you know, he didn't really have to. He could have resigned, but of course he's, you know, that's obviously not what he's there for. In any case, this is just crazy on a political level. The 2018 election, healthcare was the, Trump was the subtext, of course, of the election, and everybody knows that people were sending a message about Trump. But the issue, the one issue that everybody was concerned about, was healthcare. And, you know, they were not looking to have it repealed. They were looking to have it expanded or changed into a much more robust plan than it already is. And that is not what Trump has in mind, and repeal certainly won't accomplish that. They have no plan to replace it. They don't have any ideas even on how to replace it, and we know that. We've seen what they've come up with, which, you know, in the past has just been ridiculous. So in any case, this is just a crazy political thing. Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, or the minority leader in the House, apparently told Trump, you know, don't do this. You're going to kill us with this thing. But Trump is adamant about it. He thinks it's a winner. And he's operating out of a sense, and I think this is an important thing to realize what is motivating Trump here. He's motivated by vengeance, and you can see, all through his life he has said this, get even. He went to Jerry Falwell University back in 2013 and gave a speech to those Christian students about how the one thing you got to remember is you got to get even, you get vengeance. And normally he says you screw people who screw you, but he did clean up his language for that venue. But he has said this over and over again. And when the Barr letter came out and Trump erroneously claimed exoneration, he also said, I want them to go after, this can never happen to a president again. I want them to go after the Obama administration. Lindsey Graham's out there talking about another special counsel and all of this. And now this health care thing, which I think, as we know from his, continuing needling and insults toward John McCain, he never liked him, but that health care vote really sticks in his craw. So this is his way. He's saying, I'm going to get even, and I'm going to get even by repealing Obamacare. I'm going to show you people. We're going to investigate Obama. We're going to investigate Clinton again. We're going to repeal Obamacare, and, I'll show you. Well, all of that is he's absolutely shooting himself in both feet and the head, because on a political level, none of that makes any sense. And his party knows that, but of course, what are they going to do? I heard Susan Collins said that she was, really upset. So, there you go. I think that's about it. And, we'll see them. And they'll they're going to follow this lawsuit and completely give the Democrats they couldn't have given them a better gift going into this next election than backing this lawsuit. I mean, it just couldn't be any better, really, other than, Trump being hauled off to jail or something. But this is absolutely a ridiculous political decision on his part. And, I think it's just driven purely by emotion. I don't think it has anything to do with strategy or distraction or anything else.
I mean, I think there's an argument that he thinks this is going to be a base election, that he can't have his base abandon him, and that they will be able in some way to harm the Democratic nominee so much that it will be a race to see who does not lose the 2020 presidential election first. I happen to think that's not going to work this time around. That was a strategy last time. But who knows? In the meantime, we are out of time. Heather, as always, much appreciated. Crazy week, but we'll be back next week with more.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Coming up, the U.S. is not the only country in turmoil. Yassim Serhan from the Atlantic magazine will be here to explain what's going on with Brexit. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Here's a timely reminder, since you're currently listening to Ring of Fire Live. You know that you can access Ring of Fire on demand on your desktop, on your laptop, on your tablet, your smartphone. That's right, Ring of Fire is available on demand, so you can listen commercial-free at your convenience. To subscribe to the podcast and gain access to the news the mainstream media misses, and all the interviews with lawmakers, lawbreakers, and newsmakers. Never miss a minute and support our effort at the same time. It's a sweet deal. Check it out, the Ring of Fire commercial-free podcast on demand whenever and wherever you want to listen. Just $7.95 a month, or for real savings, $59.40 a year. Help us continue to bring you quality investigative reporting, whistleblowing, and our patented, insightful, fearless commentary. Just head to ringoffireradio.com and click on podcast and sponsor at the top of the page. Hello, you. You who listens to the Ring of Fire podcast, whether you listen to our one-hour podcast weekly, or you're a supporting member of Ring of Fire Radio who listens to our bonus content and our three-hour weekly commercial-free show. Speaking for Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio, we can't tell you how much we appreciate your listening. And now you have an opportunity to introduce others to the progressive ideas, issues, and voices you hear each week on Ring of Fire Radio. Help us win an award at podcastawards.com. Head over to podcastawards.com and nominate us for Best News in Politics Award. You can send a message as we compete against the right-wing and corporate news shows that there is a hunger in this country for truth-telling and progressive ideals. Go to podcastawards.com and nominate Ring of Fire Radio for Best in News and Politics right now. Hey, thanks for your help. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Cedar. We'll be back with a new show next week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. For most Americans, Brexit probably seems pretty straightforward in the fact that the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, but nothing could be further from the truth. Here to walk us through what's really going on across the pond, Yasmin Serhan from The Atlantic magazine. So, Yasmin, this has been going on for quite some time, a couple of years now, and I don't think that I know anyone, despite the fact that I also professionally follow the news, that I know anyone in this country who can actually give me a comprehensive explanation of what is going on. My sense is part of the reason for that is that at any given moment, it feels like, and particularly this week, it feels like what's going on with Brexit is constantly changing and having all sorts of maybe expected consequences and maybe unexpected consequences with the British government, the politics, et cetera. So give us the thumbnail where we've been up to fairly recently, I guess, in terms of Brexit, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you're certainly not alone in feeling like it's hard to kind of keep track of this story, because despite the fact, as you say, as though it feels like things are changing all the time, what's actually been kind of frustrating for reporters like me here is that for a long time, nothing has changed, like consequentially, at least. We've sort of been fighting the same battle for a long time. And a lot of the changes that have been happening have to do with like things people say and, you know, new deadlines and stuff like that. But effectively where we are is that Theresa May negotiated a Brexit agreement with the European Union. Late last year, they agreed to it. And the battle for her up to this point has been to get enough support for it in Parliament, in the House of Commons. And thus far, she's failed to do so. She had two votes.
Well, before we get to the votes, Yasmin.
Oh, sure.
Just give us the broad outlines. What does she have to negotiate with the EU to leave the EU? And what is it in the nature of the negotiations make it difficult? Because I'm not even sure that people understand that, you know, they presume, I think people presume, and it's if we're not familiar with British politics in any real meaningful way, the presumption is, okay, we voted to leave the EU. Let's just leave the EU. What's the problem? What did Theresa May negotiate with the EU? And what were the sort of the limitations on what she could give or get? And then we'll talk about why that's been such a hard sell domestically.
Sure. Yeah. So basically what this whole thing has been about, these negotiations about Britain leaving the EU for the past 2 years, has been basically the terms of that withdrawal, what it looks like to leave the EU, what it looks like to untangle Britain's 46-year relationship with the largest trading body in the world. Because, you know, being part of the European Union means so many things for British life. So it's basically, how does Britain extricate itself from the bloc? So these negotiations have covered everything from the money that Britain has committed to the European Union budget. How much money should it pay the EU to kind of cover its existing balance, so to speak? What to do with things like citizens' rights? Being part of the EU means that all Europeans living in EU countries can live and work freely across all the 28 member states. So what do you do with the people who live in Britain who aren't British, and what rights do they get to keep? And then the third and final big thing that these negotiations covered was what to do with the Irish border. Basically, the UK-EU border once the UK leaves, and once it leaves the single market and the customs union, which effectively means when there isn't free trade going across that border, which has since been invisible. What do you do with that? And how do you maintain peace on the island of Ireland? So despite it seemingly feeling like a very simple concept of Britain voted to leave, then why don't they just leave? There's actually a lot of loose ends that they need to tighten up before they do that. And that's what the last 2 years have been about.
It sort of feels like the referendum on leaving left a little bit too much up to the imagination on some level.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because I think the problem was that Brexit was always framed as a moment when, in fact, it's been a process. And I think, you know, leave and remain are such open-ended kind of ideas. And I think what we found throughout this process is that people across Parliament, across the country, have very different ideas for what leaving the EU like and how Britain should leave the EU. And these last 2 years have actually been about kind of having that discussion and that debate. What's been troubling and what's kind of been the issue and sort of the downfall for this government ultimately is that they didn't have this debate before they triggered Article 50 and started the process of leaving the EU. Article 50 is the exit mechanism. So kind of starting the two-year process, they didn't come to some sort of consensus for what they wanted out of leaving the EU and what they wanted that departure to look like. Instead, they triggered it 2 years ago on Friday and basically then scrambled to try to figure out what it is they wanted. And that's kind of why they're at the impasse that they're at now.
So to be clear, this provision 51, is it the exit provision? That is an EU bylaw. Right. And so Britain triggered it and thought 2 years would be enough. And it feels like maybe it's not. And so Theresa May goes to the EU and says, you know, it's basically working out a divorce of some sort. This is what we're going to do with the kids. This is what where I'm going to pay off these debts that we owed. But what is the leverage that the EU has to negotiate with Great Britain? I mean, I guess it's more, is it just a question of like, okay, well, I mean, if you're not going to pay us what you had committed to paying us, we're going to make it very hard for your products to travel into Europe. I mean, good luck trading with whoever's left, essentially. I hope you have good boats or something, right? I mean, is that basically what it comes down to?
Not quite. See, I think it would be a mistake to frame it as sort of, you know, I mean, it is, a divorce is like an apt metaphor. It's exactly what it is. But I think both sides want it to be amicable. Because imagine if you're divorcing someone, but they're also your next door neighbor. So you're going to see them all the time. And you actually, right, you know, you work together. You trade with each other. You're each other's, in this case, quite literally the largest trading partners. You have close coordination on things like security and defense. I mean, you guys are best buds and you want to stay that way. But you need to find a way to separate and have some distance. So, you know, I think both sides have an incentive, both economically for themselves, but I mean, also for each other to want this to work. And I think you even hear some of the most ardent Brexit advocates on the British side saying, look, you know, this isn't because I hate the EU. Like we you know, they, at the end of the day, they want to turn around and strike a trade deal with them. So it's in everyone's interest for these divorce proceedings to go well. And I think that's ultimately what's kind of bound people a bit in these negotiations, is that they can't afford to kind of just flip the table and walk away, because it's going to come back to haunt both sides in the end when right, they need to figure out some sort of future relationship, not just for them, but for their citizens that live on the opposite sides of the channel, and also for Ireland and that Irish border, which both sides care about so much.
All right, Yasmin, you've given us a very good description of, I guess, the tension that exists, both parties trying to come in, get the best deal, but also not to take advantage of each other in such a way that there is a lingering resentment. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll start to discuss, I guess, the British domestic politics, because that is, at the end of the day, it seems to me, the most tumultuous player or part of the equation in this instance. And I also want to talk about, broadly speaking, about the two major parties. What are the forces that are impacting what they feel they need to get out of these negotiations? And where are we on the clock? We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Yasmin Serhan in just a moment.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. I like my toast done on one side. But you can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York.
Hi, I'm Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire. In order to continue to bringing you the news and opinions that matter to progressives, we encourage you to help support our efforts. You can do that by shopping on Amazon.com using the link on our website at ringoffireradio.com. Ring of Fire will receive a portion of all sales that originate through our site, so you can shop as usual and help support Progressive Media. Just bookmark the Amazon link at ringoffireradio.com and help support Progressive Media.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking with Esim Sarhan from The Atlantic magazine about her piece, "Even Now, Brexit Remains Impossible to Understand." So, Yasmin, in the last segment, you basically walked us through the dynamic that's happening with Brexit. Explain to us that Brexit was not just a moment. It was basically voting to engage in a process, and that perhaps Great Britain was not, England was not particularly cautious in triggering the exit, I guess, provision of the EU. And now they seem to be running out of time. Theresa May, I feel like we've read a couple of stories, at least on this side of the Atlantic, that suggested that Theresa May was, her leadership was in serious jeopardy, in peril at different times, because she can't seem to make a deal with the EU that she can sell to her domestic audience. Like, what is, before we talk about just like the actual predicament she's in, what is it that she's giving to the EU that her the constituency she needs domestically is unsatisfied with?
It's a great question. I mean, it kind of runs the gambit with things that, you know, her opponents don't like about the deal she's negotiated with the EU. But the main thing that people tend to point to that they don't like is a thing called the Irish backstop, which basically is something that, in order to prevent a hard border forming on the island of Ireland that separates Northern Ireland, which is in the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is in the EU, to prevent there from being a hard border, that the UK would, temporarily speaking, stay closely tied to the EU rules and regulations when it comes to trade until they figure out some sort of trade deal, and then it won't be needed anymore. I know that all sounded really complex, but the reason that a lot of Brexiteers don't like it is because when they leave the EU, they want to go out there and start forming trade deals with countries like the US. And others around the world, and they feel like they can't do that so long as they're tied to EU rules, because it limits their ability to negotiate with other countries and strike these trade deals that they want. So that's a big reason. It's the Irish backstop, which again is meant to be temporary. In fact, both the EU and the UK have said they don't want it to go into effect at all, but they need it as some sort of like insurance policy effectively to make sure that the Irish border doesn't become a hard one, that the Good Friday Agreement is maintained. So that's a big issue. But I mean, principally, the reason that people don't like her deal across the country really runs the gambit. And again, it, as we were talking about before, it kind of depends on what people want out of Brexit. For some people, particularly on the opposition Labour Party, they want to maintain a close economic relationship with the EU, even if that does mean sticking to their rules. For others, they don't want to leave the EU at all and think that they should oppose May's deal and try pushing for a second referendum to hopefully get the country to stay. So, you know, her deal's opponents don't all have one reason. For many, it's because they just simply want their own version of Brexit.
So and are there, so it sounds like there are people who the Remain folk, they obviously would complain about the deal because they don't want any deal. And so complaining about the details of the deal is the most expedient way to perhaps articulate that. Are there, and then there are others who seem to be, you know, somewhat impatient, as you're expressing, that they don't want to get...
They just want to leave. Yeah.
They just want to leave. They don't want to get mired. They don't want to get mired in a sort of like a separation as opposed to a divorce, because those things can go on for a long time. But are there constituencies who presumably have, they are ostensibly for Brexit, but are worried about, like, they took that position out of maybe some measure of expedience or as a reflection of the people that vote for them. And I should remind people that the British government is a parliamentary system. So you have a lot of different agendas that aren't necessarily sort of melded into a big umbrella as much as, you know, people are maybe gathering around like some type of shelter, I guess. And so they are there constituencies that sort of aren't really as Brexity as they appear. And so the best thing for them is to keep having an issue with the deal. I'm just trying to get a sense of, like, it feels like that every single member of the British population has a slightly different take on what should happen.
Yeah, it is a bit complicated. I mean, basically, it really does run the gambit. I mean, there are some people within the population who, when they said that when they voted to leave, they just wanted to cut ties completely and just go, even if that means with no deal. There are others who, you know, maybe certain aspects of being a member of the EU, like freedom of movement, as we were discussing, they want that to end. And so they want to kind of, you know, keep the economic cooperation, but they want to stop that. And then there are others who, you know, who obviously, as we said, want to stay. I mean, there isn't really a dichotomy in terms of, you know, it's not just as simple as leave and remain. I mean, various other kind of visions for Brexit emerged. I mean, I've talked to business, small to medium-sized business owners who want a customs union because they're worried about their businesses and their future and the uncertainty. But I've also talked to others who, precisely because of their businesses, because of regulations that are made at the EU level, which obviously the UK as a member state had a role in making, because they don't like those regulations, they want to leave. So, you know, it really you often find that it tends to be for very personal reasons. That I don't think people were necessarily, you know, I think obviously a lot of things that were said during the referendum, seemingly erroneous things like how much money would be saved for the National Health Service and stuff like that, swayed a lot of people's opinions. But you find that people tend to have very specific reasons for why they voted for this, which again, I think makes coming to a consensus on what Brexit should look like quite difficult.
All right. So we have about 90 seconds left here. What happens with Theresa May? I mean, does she at one point just say, like, I can't do it. Bye. I'm taking off. I'm early retirement. This is just not a job that I can deal with.
You know what? It's funny. When she called for a general election and then ended up losing her majority instead of gaining a bigger one, she ran basically a promise of being strong and stable leadership. And throughout this process, we've seen that she's been profoundly weak, yet surprisingly stable. She's kind of just buggered on with everything and just kind of kept pushing. And she's been known for that. People have, you know, really have come to admire that about her, even if they hate everything else. That all kind of changed on Wednesday night, where she sort of played her last card and told her colleagues in Parliament. She said, look, I will set I will leave. I will end my my premiership early if you back my deal, and then we can have a new prime minister to take us through the next phase of the negotiations, which is about the future relationship and the trade deal and so on. So she's ultimately seems to be willing to sacrifice herself for this deal and ultimately for her party. So she may very well end up leaving. And this is Brexit is pretty much how she's going to be remembered, if that's the case.
Wow. And with just like 20 seconds left, we only have like about a week or two left, right? And then it's just drop dead. EU says bye-bye.
See, that's the thing. We really don't know. We don't know when Brexit is supposed to happen. It was supposed to happen on Friday. That was the date that was promised for 2 years. Then because they knew it clearly they weren't going to reach it in time, the EU offered them an extension either to April 12th or to May 22nd, depending on when they pass her deal. So to be honest with you, Sim, by this point, we're probably actually going to know if it's April 12th or May, because it'll probably be decided by the end of the week. But I mean, the truth of the matter is we just don't know. We will have to wait and see. But that's the frustrating thing with Brexit. You kind of just have to always wait and see.
Well, Yasmin Serhan, thank you so much for explaining it to us to the extent that it's possible to understand with the human brain. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
Yasmin Serhan is a London-based assistant editor at The Atlantic. Coming up, two incredibly consequential gerrymandering cases making their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll discuss their implications with the voting rights expert, Ari Berman. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
Turn your magic on, with me she'd say, everything you want to dream away, we are legends, every day, that's what she told me.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, this is Sam Cedar. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to the third hour of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. I want to thank all of our listeners who've taken the time to subscribe to our podcast, whether it's the free version that you can get on iTunes or wherever your podcasts are served, or in particular, our member program over at ROFpodcast.com. We really do appreciate your support. Two cases involving gerrymandering are making their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Conservative majority sitting on the court has signaled it may preserve the politically motivated maps. Here to explain what would happen if that's the case, voting rights expert Ari Berman from Mother Jones Magazine. So, Ari, we have two cases that are in front of the Supreme Court at the moment. Oral arguments happened last week, one out of North Carolina, one out of Maryland. Before we get to those two states, we got to first talk about Gill v. Whitford, because when we talk about gerrymandering cases, in many respects, Gill v. Whitford gave us a really, in many respects, distasteful preview for what we can expect. What was that case, Gill v. Whitford?
So last year, there was a really landmark case for Wisconsin where a voting rights group challenged the Republican state assembly maps in Wisconsin. And what happened in Wisconsin, like a lot of states, is that Republicans took control after the 2010 election, and they drew this incredible gerrymander so they could actually win fewer votes but more seats. So in the last election in Wisconsin, Democrats won all five races for statewide office in Wisconsin, including the governor's race. And they won 54% of the votes for the state assembly, which is the state house. But they only got 36% of seats. So the flip side of that is that Republicans in Wisconsin got 46% of the votes, but they managed to get 64% of the seats in the state assembly there, which just goes against everything we think a democracy is supposed to be about.
Hold on for 1 second, because I think, you know, I don't think that we can spend too much time just on that figure, because not only does it go against, I think, what everyone's concept of democracy is, it goes against what everyone's concept of math is. Like, I think it's hard for people to really wrap their heads around that concept. I mean, we have, I guess, the Electoral College in some respects is sort of similar in that way. But this is really crazy. There was, out of, if 100 votes are cast, 56 of them are cast for Democrats, 44 are cast for Republicans, but Republicans win 64 seats, and that is because of the way that the votes have been manipulated and clustered in such a way where you have basically people voting and their vote just doesn't carry the same amount of weight as maybe others in another district.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because Wisconsin is basically a quintessential purple state. It was carried by Barack Obama twice, then Donald Trump very narrowly won in 2016, but it's a state that has elected last year, reelected a Democratic senator, elected a Democratic governor, but the state legislature there, which has been heavily gerrymandered by the state legislature there, has just been impenetrable for Democrats. And we have seen a situation in multiple elections now where Republicans are getting a minority of votes but a majority of seats, and their numbers stay the same no matter the national mood. So it doesn't matter if it's 2010, it's a wave election, or it's for Republicans, or it's 2018, a wave election for Democrats. The numbers in the state legislature for Republicans just stay the same. They always have a very clear majority. And that's why these maps were challenged, because the plaintiffs basically said, this is completely undemocratic, and this is obviously a partisan gerrymander. How else could you get a situation where someone could win 54% of the vote but only 36% of the seat? So they challenged this case before the Supreme Court. It was heard last year, and there was a lot of hope that there would be some sort of major resolution of gerrymandering because the evidence in Wisconsin was so startling. But the Supreme Court basically punted, said that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to challenge this, and sent it back to lower courts for a whole nother go-around.
And so where before we get to where that case is on the lower courts, but there was also some sense that Anthony Kennedy, this would be this was the case that he was waiting for. Right. I mean, there were gerrymandering cases years ago. Kennedy basically said, like, how can we assess how badly something is gerrymandered? Because obviously, you know, gerrymandering has been around for a long time. There's new technologies now that actually can, you know, put it in hyperdrive, which is what we see in Wisconsin. But he was calling for some means in which to measure how badly something is gerrymandered. And social scientists came up with one. I mean, you and I can hear this and we can say there's something wrong there, but they came up with a way of quantifying it. And that was not sufficient for Anthony Kennedy, even though he had been basically calling out into the wilderness saying, you know, show me something like this so we can make a decision.
Yeah, so there was a big 2004 case from Pennsylvania that the Supreme Court heard. And basically four conservative justices led by Antonin Scalia said that the Supreme Court should never review partisan gerrymandering because gerrymandering is an inherently political act that the court should stay out of. There were four liberal justices that said, no, partisan gerrymandering should be illegal. We can tell when this goes from being something that is a relatively political process, something that's really extreme and hurtful to our democracy. And Kennedy was basically in the middle, where he said, I'm not ready to join the liberals, but I'm not ready to join the conservatives, and I want to see a clear standard here for when we should strike down something as too gerrymandered or too political. And so the plaintiffs in Wisconsin spent a lot of time developing this theory. One of the theories was called the efficiency gap, but there were other social science behind it. And basically they were able to measure for the first time concretely the number of wasted votes. They were able to basically say these maps are so extreme that Democratic votes have been diluted to X or Y extent beyond what would happen if you drew a neutral map based on fair districting criteria. And they thought that was enough. They thought that that was something that you could use. You could basically use math and social science to identify these very extreme cases. But Kennedy evidently didn't want to go there, didn't sign off on this opinion. And what happened was that in the end, there just were not five votes for striking down partisan gerrymandering in the Wisconsin case.
And so where did Where did Gil v. Whitford, it went back to the lower courts. Where is it now within the lower court system?
It was sent back to lower court. They basically told, not to get too tactical, but they basically told them you have to find plaintiffs in every district. So what they were doing in Wisconsin is they were challenging the entire map and saying the entire map was an unconstitutional gerrymander. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, you need to find specific districts where plaintiffs have problems, where they can prove that their district was gerrymandered. And so they went back and did that. It's before the lower courts. Then they decided to hear two other cases from North Carolina and Maryland. And right now the Wisconsin case is basically pending based on the outcome of these other cases that they've now heard.
All right. Well, look, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear about those other two cases that are coming out of Maryland and North Carolina. And I want you to be prepared to answer the question, how could they take these cases when they had such an obvious case of crazy gerrymander that they just punted on? We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Ari Berman in a moment. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
Sam Cedar here. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Ari Berman from Mother Joins Magazine about his piece, Supreme Court's Conservative Majority is Worried That Every Vote Might Count Equally. So, Ari, let me ask you this. How is it that the Supreme Court can be taking these two cases, one from North Carolina, one from Maryland, when they punted on Gil v. Whitford, which was the case out of Wisconsin? Now, did not have the opportunity to see the results from the 2018 election, where you had 54% of the people going to the polls voting for a Democrat, and Democrats winning only 36 of the 100 seats in the Wisconsin state legislature. That, I mean, just off the top of my head, that means that each Democrat who voted had a vote that was worth only 66% of every vote for a Republican. Do you think if Kennedy had seen that result, that maybe this would have been a more compelling case for them?
So, I mean, there was evidence, though, that was very much like that in the Wisconsin case already, because it happened in 2012. In 2012, Democrats got something like 52% of the vote in Wisconsin, and were only able to get 30-something percent of the seat. So this has already happened in Wisconsin. And indeed, in another case they heard in North Carolina just recently, something very similar happened. So Democrats in North Carolina got 49% of the vote. So it wasn't quite a majority, but it was very close to a majority. Democratic candidates for Congress in North Carolina got 49% of the votes, but Republicans got 75% of the seats. So dramatic, basically it's a 50-50 state, but one party is getting 75% of congressional seats. And of course, they also committed election fraud to win another seat there. And what's amazing about the North Carolina case is the guy who drew it, the state rep who drew it, basically just admitted what he was doing. He said, and I'm just going to give you a quote, he said, "I propose that we draw the map to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats."
Right.
So it's just admitting his criteria is give me a map that's 10-3. Then he says, "I admit this is a partisan gerrymander, which is not illegal." was like, okay, well, clearly you think that the Supreme Court's just going to bail you out here because you're stating your intentions in an incredibly honest way. Usually you try to make up some sort of excuse
right.
as to why you were gerrymandering. Here he's just saying, we're gerrymandering. This is what I want to do. I want 10 Republicans, and I want 3 Democrats, even though North Carolina is a 50-50 state. And so that case is now before the Supreme Court.
And the Maryland case
didn't seem that disturbed. Go ahead.
The Maryland case is one where the Democrats supposedly gerrymandered for political advantage. Yes?
Well, they didn't supposedly do it. They definitely did do it. Democrats have done this too. They haven't done it as badly as Republicans have, and they don't control as many states as Republicans have. But Democrats did it too in Maryland. They took a district that was basically a rural Republican district. They drew 66,000 Republicans out of the district. They moved 24,000 Democrats into the district. They moved it all the way up to Washington, D.C. suburbs from rural Maryland. And they create a very reliably Democratic district, and the one that is 7-1 now. Maryland's congressional delegation is 7-1 Democratic to Republican. Now, Maryland is a blue state, but nonetheless, that is still well beyond, I think, what Democrats should have there. And it's interesting. So you had two cases before the Supreme Court. You had a North Carolina case where the Republicans were gerrymandering, and you had a case of Maryland where the Democrats were gerrymandering. Now, of course, the Supreme Court's conservative justices seemed furious about the Democratic gerrymandering in Maryland. John Roberts was basically like, how could you discriminate against Democrats? Now, that seems like the height of cynicism. To say that you're going to potentially strike down a Democratic gerrymander in Maryland, but not a Republican one in North Carolina. But what my feeling is that any sort of opinion striking down gerrymandering will be good for Democrats, even if it's one that strikes down one of their districts, because it'll say to the Supreme Court will say there are some limits on this process, and then Democrats
right.
can use that in the future to challenge. Other Republican gerrymanders. At least that's the only hope here, because the justices basically said when we talked about the same stats that you did, Sam, where you said, oh, how could you have a situation where it's 54% Democratic, but they only get 36% of seats? What the conservative justices said, well, what do you want, proportional representation? They said this 70 times.
Wow.
That's the oral argument. Proportional representation, purport. I was writing it, and I'm like, how many times am I going to write this phrase? I just kept writing PR after a while because they just kept saying it so many times. And so, like, they have invented this crazy boogeyman to try to justify these insane gerrymanders, and that's the problem here. And Kennedy didn't do anything, but there's no sign that Brett Kavanaugh is going to be any better than he is.
All right. We have about 2.5 minutes left. The other concern, it seems, is that there's indications, and correct me if I'm wrong, that not only does the conservatives on the court feel that it is there is no amount of partisan gerrymandering that can in any way abridge someone's right to vote or equal protection in terms of the value of their vote. But they also are starting to indicate that they do not believe that the state, any state, can in some way outsource the decision to how to draw districts to an independent commission, right? Because that they are saying not only do we not think it's impossible to abridge people's right to vote, but that we can only have a system that invites that.
Yeah, so this was another really interesting part of the oral arguments, which is that Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh both talked about how states were adopting independent redistricting commissions as a reason why the Supreme Court didn't need to get involved. They said, well, if these commissions are going to exist, why does the court need to get involved? The states are solving it for themselves. The problem is that in 2015, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission, which draws commissions in a nonpartisan way for congressional seats. And 4 conservative justices voted, including John Roberts, to gut that commission. So the ultimate cynic could say that what the Supreme Court's conservative justices are trying to do here is say, A, we're not going to hear it because we're not going to do anything about gerrymandering because already states are drawing commissions to solve the problem. But then we are going to turn around and gut those very commissions as an infringement on state legislative power. That would be an unbelievable act of cynicism and hypocrisy by the conservative justices. But here we are. I mean, they seem to be invoking.
I was going to say the success.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we'll have you back on when they make that very decision, which with this court would not shock me, but we're out of time. Ari Berman, we'll keep our eye on this. I know that we will hear about these cases one way or another by July, and we'll have you back on to discuss at that point what we do next if we are doomed to have these type of completely unbalanced federal elections. Ari Berman, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Sam. Great to talk to you again.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Coming up, we'll grade the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives on their oversight function with Jeff Hauser. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Here's a timely reminder, since you're currently listening to Ring of Fire Live. You know that you can access Ring of Fire on demand on your desktop, on your laptop, on your tablet, your smartphone. That's right. Ring of Fire is available on demand, so you can listen commercial free at your convenience. To subscribe to the podcast and gain access to the news the mainstream media misses and all the interviews with lawmakers, lawbreakers, and newsmakers. Never miss a minute and support our effort at the same time. It's a sweet deal. Check it out, the Ring of Fire commercial-free podcast on demand whenever and wherever you want to listen. Just $7.95 a month, or for real savings, $59.40 a year. Help us continue to bring you quality investigative reporting, whistleblowing, and our patented, insightful, fearless commentary. Just head to ringoffireradio.com and click on podcast and sponsor at the top of the page. Hello, you. You who listens to the Ring of Fire podcast, whether you listen to our one-hour podcast weekly or you're a supporting member of Ring of Fire Radio who listens to our bonus content and our three-hour weekly commercial-free show. Speaking for Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio, we can't tell you how much we appreciate your listening. And now you have an opportunity to introduce others to the progressive ideas, issues, and voices you hear each week on Ring of Fire Radio. Help us win an award at podcastawards.com. Head over to podcastawards.com and nominate us for Best News in Politics Award. You can send a message as we compete against the right wing and corporate news shows that there is a hunger in this country for truth telling and progressive ideals. Go to podcastawards.com and nominate Ring of Fire Radio for Best in News in Politics right now. Hey, thanks for your help. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Cedar. We'll be back with a new show next week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. How is the Democratic-controlled 116th Congress doing when it comes to putting pressure on the Trump administration and overseeing the wild and varied malfeasance? Let's ask my next guest, Jeff Hauser, from the Revolving Door Project. So, Jeff, we are post the Mueller report, but undoubtedly when if and when we see the actual contents of the report, as opposed to a summary by a handpicked attorney general by Donald Trump, who has already weighed in on some of the issues before the report was issued. Presumably, some elements of that report may go into oversight, but this is a good time to assess how the Democrats are doing on their own accord, aside from sitting around and waiting for Mueller to issue a report, how they are doing in terms of oversight. Give me a sense of how you think they're doing. And then I want to talk about this concept of demobilization. But let's start with that oversight.
Sure. I think the short answer is that they're doing poorly. there are two tasks before the Democrats in the House. One is to actually do the oversight, to do the investigations, to uncover the facts that they should be uncovering. And in order to do that in an effective and as expeditious as possible manner, they should be issuing subpoenas because they are dealing with a Trump administration that is not going to share the information that an executive branch would normally share with Congress. And they're also dealing with a corporate sector, which they should be providing oversight of, that is also not necessarily the most cooperative with our country's elected representatives. And so we are seeing in general Congress not being as aggressive as it should be. We're seeing some exceptions. Benny Thompson on the Homeland Security Committee, he's the chairman, and he is definitely passionate about uncovering some of the mistreatment of children, refugees, migrants, and that's obviously very appreciated. Elijah Cummings at the House Oversight Committee has done some good work in that regard. Maxine Waters at House Financial Services is definitely committed to oversight. But many committees have been slothful, and in general, the right information is not being accessed. But the second question is not only finding out the facts, but weaving them together into a narrative that is intelligible and relevant to the lives of ordinary Americans. And in that regard, Democrats have been so sort of timid about oversight, in part because they don't want to seem like they're pushing for impeachment, that they are not telling an effective narrative about a corrupt president, about a president who is corrupt in senses that are both criminal and in senses that are merely moral and political and go against the values of the Constitution and the country and basic decency. And the failure to tell that story is political malpractice, and it also undermines the rule of law. So overall, I would say I'm very disappointed in oversight.
So, all right. So, Jeff, let me just go back to the oversight, and then we'll talk about we'll return again to the mobilization. But they're being slothful. I mean, where should they be at this point? Like, I mean, I'm quite surprised, because my sense is that the Democrats in particular, perhaps, but maybe politicians in general, but let's say Democrats, because I've been down this road before in 2006 and into 2007, that they're often fighting the last war. And the last big success you had in terms of a Congress, seems to me, was at least this corruption narrative. And for the life of me, I don't know. And I thought maybe the Bush administration was a reasonable paradigm for this. But I don't know that you could imagine a more sort of like thoroughly varied and like deep and wide examples of corruption as we've seen with the Trump administration and incompetence, et cetera, et cetera. What's the problem here in terms of the Democratic Party? Is it a lack of will? Is it a lack of ability to execute? Is it that they just haven't been able to staff up? I mean, what's going on with that?
I mean, there are many factors that you mentioned and others are at least partially relevant here. But I think the single biggest fear is that Democrats fear doing something that proves counterproductive. And they are so good at talking themselves into the possibility that an action could, boomerang back on them, that they don't act at all. I call this learned helplessness. But they're basically the smartest person in the room is the person who comes up with the most plausible downside of an action. And that's why Democrats in general will kind of default to doing nothing. And oversight is definitely something. It's picking fights with this administration. And I think that you have a lot of Democrats, professional Democrats, even some mediocre pollsters, who will tell you that voters want to see positive policy come out of Washington. They don't want to see fighting. And they're not focused on the manifold ways in which Donald Trump is sort of individually a monster. His monstrous behavior, his treatment of women, his personal racism, all sorts of things which are relevant in public policy, but mostly go to, in this sort of telling, to who he is as a person. And they don't want people to focus on Trump as an individual. They want to focus on public policy. But the difference is that on corruption undermines how the executive branch is being run. It tilts the nature of the executive branch away from serving the public interest, and instead it serves the corporate masters and cronies of Donald Trump, and then Donald Trump and his family himself and itself. So it is very much about public policy to provide oversight of the many ways in which Trump is corrupt, both the conspicuous, like the Trump Hotel, and then the less conspicuous but no less malevolent stuff going on at the EPA or in the financial regulatory bodies or, basically name a department, housing and urban development, et cetera. That sort of corruption really undermines the physical well-being of millions and millions of Americans, and it's not a distraction. It's not saying that Trump is uncouth. It is saying that Trump is unfit, he is corrupt, and he is selling out the interests of the American people. But I think, so many Democrats think that that going after Trump on corruption would be akin to going after Bill Clinton on Monica Lewinsky. And I just don't think that there is much, they have much to do with each other.
And so what, at that point, the question, it sort of begs the question. So what is it that the Democrats think they should be doing? Right. Like, there's really only one thing that they can actually accomplish, and that is oversight at this point. Right.
From my vantage point, yes. The paradigmatic example of Democratic slothfulness is this guy, Richard Neal. He is a 16th term congressman from Western Massachusetts, and he is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, a very powerful position that he has secured through no act other than survival. He has just been in Congress for a really long time, and ergo, he is the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. And he could have done what, in fact, Nancy Pelosi had promised would occur on day one, which was to request Donald Trump's tax returns, which have been of great interest. And the Democrats, in fact, unquestionably ran for office on the basis of the idea that they would, in fact, obtain Donald Trump's tax returns on day one. And he has not done so. What is he doing instead? Well, he's talking to the Trump administration about infrastructure. He's talking to the Trump administration about Trump's NAFTA deal. He's talking to the Trump administration about some technical tweaks around the edges of the Trump tax bill from 2017. In other words, he is trying to act like we are in a normal era of politics with a normal Republican president like George H.W. Bush or Gerald Ford is in the White House. And that is just not true. And I don't think that's how Democrats retook the majority, by pretending that Donald Trump was Gerald Ford reincarnated. But that's how Richard Neal is acting, and I think he is doing so with, unfortunately, the support of Nancy Pelosi.
All right, we got to take a break. I want to talk about, why that's happening, and also how what you've just described, this is implicating the Democrat, the rank and file, the Democratic Party. In the first 2 years of the Trump administration, we saw what I think was an unparalleled mobilization of Democratic and left of Democratic folks on a varied number of issues. And we haven't seen any of that now that Democrats have taken the House. I want to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Hauser about this more. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Falling from high places, falling through lost spaces. Now that we're lonely, now that there's nowhere to go. Watching from both sides, these clock towers burning up. I lost my time here, I lost my patience with it all.
Hi, I'm Sam Seder from Ring of Fire. In order to continue to bringing you the news and opinions that matter to progressives, we encourage you to help support our efforts. You can do that by shopping on Amazon.com using the link on our website at ringoffireradio.com. Ring of Fire will receive a portion of all sales that originate through our site, so you can shop as usual and help support progressive media. Just bookmark the Amazon link at ringoffireradio.com and help support progressive media.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Seder's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to trofire.com. That's trofire.com.
You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking with the executive director of the Revolving Door Project, Jeff Hauser. So, Jeff, in the last segment, you were giving us a grade as to the way that Democrats, or I should say, the quality of the Democrats' Democratic oversight of the Trump administration, and it really, it really does feel like they're driving with the brakes on, as it were, and. Part of that is a temerity that they feel that, that they will be too bogged down, that it would make Donald Trump too sympathetic of a character, I guess, to have the relentless corruption uncovered in many respects. I mean, I want to get to this notion of demobilization, but what is it? I mean, what do you think? What do the Democrats intend to run on? I mean, I can understand that there is we need to have a material benefit offered to people, but doesn't there need to be basically over the next year and a half a way of keeping the Trump administration and the Republicans in particular on their heels?
I would think so. I think that the Democratic Party establishment's plan for the 2020 election cycle is to run on, and what I'm about to describe are legitimate issues. I just don't think they should be the totality of the message. But they basically want to run on the fact that Trump still wants to end Obamacare and that Democrats will defend and extend Obamacare, which is obviously an important part of a message. And, you know, you can have separate conversations about what exactly the extend Obamacare message should be. But I think they want to run on kind of standard economic issues, which, again, are important. No one disagrees with that. But if you're looking to potentially win an election by more than, say, 4 to 6 points, you know, more than duplicating, say, the 2012 Obama victory over Mitt Romney, which was, you know, secured on those sort of lunchbox standard issues, I think you're going to need to have a message that is proportionate to the reality that Donald Trump is the greatest threat to American democracy to ever reside in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and he has to be treated as the sort of unique, corrupt, craven criminal monster that he is. And I think Democrats have used that rhetoric, especially in 2017 and 2018, and they spoke a very big game. They basically suggested that there was a morality play and that Democrats had no power, but that the people themselves needed to rise up, to mobilize, to get into the streets at an unprecedented level, and to protect America's democracy. And then Democrats decided after the midterm elections that all had been returned to normal because we controlled the House of Representatives, we being the Democrats, from their point of view. And I think that that is really radically understates the degree of threat that still remains with Donald Trump as president. And I think the attempted whitewashing of Trump's crimes vis-a-vis Mueller and Attorney General Barr only begins to give you a little bit of a sense of the different threats to our democracy that are still being posed by an administration that is trying to carry out a census that will not, well, that will systemically undercount people of color. I mean, I can tell you like a bunch of different ways that I think our democracy is a threat, but I also can tell you that there are probably a lot of ways our democracy is being threatened that I don't even know about, because that's why we need investigations. But I think that the Trump administration is an unprecedented danger, and the American people can be revulsed by it, but they need to be told a story about it, and they need actions from Democrats to live up to their rhetoric. It's not enough for Democrats to call Trump a monster. They have to behave like they actually believe he's a monster, and they're not doing that right now.
I mean, I got to say, it sort of feels like not only are they not executing the game plan, but they have a different game plan. I mean, it does feel like there has been a conscious effort to sort of, you know, I use the example of, you know, driving with the brakes on, but to tamp down the outside fervor, right? Like, you know, Kavanaugh hearings, Affordable Care Act, the Muslim ban. I mean, these are just off the top of my head over the past 2 years that basically generated a wide and deep mobilization where people showed up and protested in, you know, in Congress, at airports, on the streets. There seems to have been, am I imagining that, or is it simply I'm picking up on just sort of people's sense of relief, like, oh, okay, the Republicans can't pass any legislation going forward because of the Democrat. I mean, what do you make of that dynamic?
I think that the message from Democrats that things are largely under control is why the civil society groups and the grassroots leaders who attempted to produce a mass mobilization against Trump's emergency declaration were not able to kind of achieve the same sort of liftoff that they were about the Muslim ban, the travel ban, the women's march, all the sort of high points, March for Science. I mean, there were March for Truth. There were so many massive mobilizations in 2017 and 2018. But I think in 2019, there's been a sense that Pelosi or Mueller has it, like that the time for non-usual civic engagement is over. Everything is normal. And I think that's the message that Democratic leaders are much more comfortable operating in. They didn't enjoy they didn't find it exhilarating to be in the streets with right. the hoi polloi. They feel normal politics is much more their thing, and I think they're just tired. It's extremely tiring to be somebody who's involved in the news cycle, and I'm sure you've experienced this
Believe
yourself.
Me. Well, all right. Well, yeah, and I think there's a certain amount of time. Well, let me ask you this. Okay, we have only 90 seconds left. This is a little bit slightly off topic, but do you think that it will be possible to marshal the same level of urgency now that Mueller has put to rest what I think to a certain extent were, you know, sort of the nightmare scenarios regarding Donald Trump?
I think there are going to be additional opportunities for Democrats to rekindle the sort of enthusiasm and civic engagement that they experienced. I think it may require new leadership. That new leader could be whoever becomes the nominee from the Democratic Party. And there'll be other opportunities for just different leaders in Congress to kind of step up. I think a lot happens, so I'm not like totally disconsolate that a year from now it's going to feel the same as now. But I got to say, I'm very I'm disconsolate for March 2019 for sure.
Right, indeed. All right. Well, Jeff Hauser, I appreciate your coming to talk to us, and of course, people can check out your ongoing assessment of Democratic oversight at the Revolving Door. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jeff Hauser is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Do us a favor. Subscribe to the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio. You can carry it around with you in your pocket. You can listen to it whenever you want. Find it on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your favorite podcast. And I want to thank everyone who's become a member of the full show. Your membership has made this show possible in every way. You can find the member show over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.
An empty land, I knew the pathway like the back of my hand. I felt the earth beneath my feet.
This is Mike Papantonio from Ring of Fire. We've launched a news site where you can catch all of your favorite progressive hosts under one roof. We are now the largest original content progressive site in America. Come check out the latest from Ed Schultz, Tom Hartman, Laura Flanders, David Pakman, Sam Cedar's Majority Report, and of course, all of our original Ring of Fire content by myself, Bobby, and Farron. Go to TROFIRE.com. That's TROFIRE.com.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.